people that follow Rastafari faith still do use the Bible. And in the Bible, you'll find, you know, in Revelations, you'll see reference to the tree of life. You know, it's the healing of the nation. And so followers of Rastafari will recognize that as the cannabis plant.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Different Leaf, a show for new and experienced cannabis consumers. I'm Britt Smith. This episode, we're going to be talking about the connection between ganja, reggae music, and the Rastafarian faith. Many of us, myself included, were first introduced to weed while kicking back and listening to some reggae music with some friends. The music itself is often infused with references to the sacred cannabis plant and tells the story of how marijuana is consumed by many Rastafarians for spiritual reasons. Now, a lot of reggae fans will know this cult classic film called Rockers, which really brought reggae music and arguably cannabis culture to the West in the late 1970s. Rockers was directed by a Greek artist, editor, and immigrant, Ted Bafalokas, who came to New York, fell in love with the live underground reggae music scene, and ended up rubbing shoulders with some of the super influential musicians of the time. In the mid-1970s, Bafalokas decided to make his way to Jamaica, where he shot the movie Rockers, starring literally all the most important reggae musicians of the time. Gregory Isaacs, Burning Spear, Kiddus Eye, Leroy Horsemouth Wallace, producer Jack Ruby, Peter Tosh, and despite being suspicious of Bafalokas, who was rumored to be a CIA operative while in Jamaica, Bob Marley even made an appearance in the movie. Rockers is a fictional film that feels raw and real like a documentary. It follows reggae drummer Horsemouth Wallace, who plays a musician, constantly hustling for money. Horsemouth ends up on a search for a man who stole his motorbike, and along his adventures, he runs into all of Jamaica's top reggae musicians. The movie Rockers has been credited with being the first to introduce white American audiences to the subculture of Jamaican music, Rastafarianism, and of course, weed. The Fall 21 issue of Different Leaf the magazine is now available at Barnes & Noble and Books A Millions across the country. And if you flip to page 32, you'll see our fabulous merch writer John Arvanitis' recommendation for a book called Rockers, The Making of Reggae's Most Iconic Film. The book is Bafalokas' autobiography, written in 2005, about a decade before his death. And it has tons of production stills and photos from Jamaica and New York in the 70s. And John says this newly published book is a must-have for cinephiles, reggae aficionados, and counterculture nerds. First up, we're going to check in with the publisher of the book to hear more about what's inside.
Hi, this is David Lopes here. I'm editor-at-large at Ginkgo Press. I develop original publications for the company.
Great. So let's talk first about the movie of Rockers, which has led to reggae culture and cannabis culture really coming to the West. It came in the 70s with this movie Rockers.
So the director of the film Rockers and the author of the book, Ted Bafalokas, he's originally from Greece, and he goes to study at the Rhode Island School of Design. And then he's living in New York in the mid-1970s, and he's kind of checking out the art scene. And he sees reggae musician Augustus Pablo performing. And this is the moment that really inspires him to go to Jamaica and immerse himself in the reggae scene there. So what was it about that music that really drew Ted in?
He really connected to it as folk music. You know, he's like, this is like the music in Greece. I mean, obviously, materially different, sounding different, but he's like, this is roots music, and he just connected right away. He went down to Jamaica right away, within a matter of months, I think, after seeing Augustus Pablo. Cannabis culture was inescapable, and it's not an obsession in the book, but it's a through line. He got high, he smoked with people he met, and there were customs that come out. You know, for instance, he mentions he was hanging out with some musicians, and everyone gets their own spleef, you know, there's no sharing. It's like, what? No, you big boys smoke their own spleefs. Things like that come out along the way. There's this character, Hire, who we meet throughout the course of the film. and higher, you know, one of his sort of beliefs under his own private form of Rastafarianism, thought it was not good to smoke anything. So Heyer introduced Ted to edibles. You know, in this case, he made this sort of honey concoction that Ted talks about getting them all very high, when maybe you heard about brownies or something at that point, but I don't think that was as common a thing. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
So there's a lot about the musicians that he met along the way, and a lot of these musicians, a lot of them became household names in the reggae world, and they were heavily connected to advocating for cannabis legalization at the time. Who were some of the big names that Ted really met along his
travels? Just about everyone, but I think one character looms large for me, and that's Burning Spear. You know, Bob Marley obviously was the big name at the time, but Marley was big enough to be very, very suspicious of any kind of outsider at this point. And rumors, in fact, of Bafalukos being, you know, this spook or CIA man or whatever, probably came into play, as far as, you know, Marley was very standoffish. Peter Tosh, who's probably the strongest proponent of legalization at the time, was sort of in that camp too.
What were some of the most interesting parts of his life and his experience in Jamaica that you liked the most?
I mean, Bafalukos is a real hero of mine in that, you know, he's a real stoner achiever, right? I mean, this guy, he writes brilliantly. English was his second language. And he talks about Rastafarianism in the book, but he talks about all the religions in Jamaica. Like, that's what's so great about this book to me, is he, in a pretty short text, he gives a really full picture of Jamaican culture, not just this two-dimensional kind of aspect. And so, you know, cannabis culture, for instance, is really placed in the context of, it's a very, very diverse island. You know, you had the British colonial forces, of course, were huge. In fact, the word ganja, it's from India, indentured servants that the British brought to Jamaica brought ganja in the first place. Jamaica is a real melting pot because of the British colonial influence and just it being on trade routes.
David, let me ask you one final question about the book itself. What do you think that reggae aficionados and cannabis aficionados would enjoy most about this book?
Despite the seemingly meta focus, you know, a book about a movie that came out in 1977, It's a very expansive view, actually, of the music, the culture, and cannabis culture in Jamaica during that time. And you know, I publish a lot of art books that, frankly, are just a lot of pretty pictures. But this is one where I'm really proud of the way that the narrative just brings it to like a whole other level, along with the fantastic photos of the time that Bafalukos and his crew were able to capture.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Legalize it. Next, we're going to learn about the roots of cannabis in Rastafarianism and reggae music from a family member of one of those iconic reggae musicians who was first seen by the world in the Rockers movie. Mayombe McIntosh is the youngest daughter of Peter Tosh, legendary guitarist and founding member of the Wailers. Alongside Bob Marley and Bunny Livingston, Peter Tosh wrote and recorded some of the world's most quintessential reggae music, advocating for the legalization of marijuana as a sacred plant for those of the Rastafarian faith.
Really, what I wanted to talk to you today about was your experience in Jamaica in the 70s and the 80s and sort of the connection between the reggae culture and cannabis culture.
Yes.
So your dad was in the movie Rockers, just a quick cameo, and so was some of his music. When it did show cannabis, it showed cannabis use in Jamaica as just sort of a daily thing. It was illegal, and so folks were still running from the police, but it was just sort of part of everyday life. So what are some of your memories of Jamaica as a kid and the cannabis use there?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that Jamaica was colonized by the British. And so it was very, it's still very much a Western civilization that has been dominated. And so although in the movie we see cannabis as this kind of everyday part of society, it was more so a counterculture. And, you know, my father was continuously targeted by the police for his use of cannabis and also his activism around it, you know, through his music. And so it was something that, although in certain settings it can be used in abundance, my father was a follower of Rastafari. And, you know, that spiritual practice is really about, you know, one love, but also consciousness amongst individuals that accept the plant as a sacrament. And so in that belief system, we recognize it to be something that we can use on a daily basis, but also come together communally and get a more spiritual connection with oneself and the Almighty. But it still has been something where the leaders of society in Jamaica kind of frown upon or are embarrassed to have any association with. And so it's not this kind of plant that's just used by all Jamaicans, you know, that can be the misinformation that is circulated through just the media.
That's really interesting, because I was also under the impression that it was just kind of widely used and accepted publicly there. What is it like there now in the world of cannabis?
Well, the Jamaican government has legalized cannabis for medicinal purposes. They've also recognized the Rastafarian culture in which the way that they consume. There's like a sacramental regulation where you can consume and have a certain amount if you are a follower of Rastafari or it's considered part of your faith, but it is not legalized for adult use.
So when you were growing up in Jamaica, what was it that you experienced? What kind of relationship did your family have with ganja?
I can say most of the women in my family actually don't consume. My sisters, I'm the youngest of 10, actually. And so five girls and five boys. But all of the boys and the men in my family do consume. And this is on my paternal side. But, you know, on my maternal side, where I have also a pretty large family as well, just about everyone consumes. And people ask, like, you know, who smokes or who consumes cannabis in your family, and for the most part you'd have to ask, like, who doesn't, because that's an easier question to answer.
Yeah.
So it really, growing up, has just been a way of life and something that is accepted. You know, my brothers you always see them with a spliff. I was in Jamaica last week and my brother came to town from country and he had like this huge bundle about a foot and a half long.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Of cannabis. And that's just how he rolls. You know, I could always expect him to nice. Have it, because he plans on, he comes to town, he gives, you know, some to my other brothers and different family members. As my father said, you know, it's something that just grew in abundance. And so it's something that we, you know, is easily accessible.
So do your family grow it over there, or do they just sort of have easy access to it over there? What's it like?
Both. My brother is in the countryside, and there are some plants on the property in the countryside. And it's not something that you would see in the city, so to speak. You don't want to really grow it in the city. It'd be too easy for people to try to steal it. It's not safer in the city. But in the countryside, you definitely, he does have a few stocks. And then he also has access to some of the ganja farmers that are in the West.
So I want to tap in a little more to the connection with cannabis and reggae music. Obviously, your father used it a lot to influence his music. It was used spiritually. Do you have any memories of him writing any songs while smoking or sort of playing music while he was high?
That's a funny question, because if you Google Peter Tosh now, just about every photo he has a spliff in his hand, and in any performance he has a spliff. And so it was definitely very much a part of his just day-to-day existence. A more difficult question would be, when did he not have a spliff? And so when we think about reggae music and the birth of reggae, the culture of Rastafari was born out of an anti-colonialistic movement in the 1930s. Like I said, Jamaica was colonized by the British, and every part of the Black identity was mandated by the colonizers. So how we dressed, how we looked, and even the religion was really given to Black people so that they wouldn't retaliate for slavery. Hmm. And so there was this awakening happening in the 30s and then in the 20s where there was a shift. There was a shift out of the church and then a consciousness to say, you know, I am not, this is not who I am, but this is who I was told to be. And I want to seek out my roots and my African identity and connect more with the indigenous practices of my African brothers and sisters. And that was kind of the birth of Rastafari. And so the music that we hear when reggae was born kind of came from this fight against the system. And so with cannabis being what is recognized as a sacrament because of, although there was a shift out of the church, people that follow Rastafari faith still do use the Bible. And in the Bible, you'll find, you know, in Revelations, you'll see reference to the tree of life. You know, it's the healing of the nation. And so followers of Rastafari will recognize that as the cannabis plant. You'll see references of like herbs. My father's quoted saying that herb was created by the creator for the spiritual and scientifical use of man. And it was that all of that inspiration came from a spiritual place. And then when the music was born, you know, reggae music was born, that's where it comes from. And it was this cry out against colonialism, but then also a celebration of Rastafari culture as well.
That's such an interesting thing to learn, because as an English girl who grew up, you know, in the British schooling system, I remember studying in music class, studying reggae music, and we never heard any of that.
Yes.
We were not taught, really, we were not taught sort of what our country had done to the world. And it was so whitewashed. It's ridiculous to look back on how they taught musical history or any kind of history really of the Brits. But to know that, you know, so much music was sort of born out of this injustice, it makes me look at the music in a very different way. And I think as I grew up, I stopped just sort of bopping along to the Wailers, and I started really listening to some of the words. Like, I remember the first one that really hit me was Buffalo Soldier. When I really sat down and listened to the words of it, I think I was a teenager. I think I was smoking weed, which, you know, helps you connect to the music sometimes.
No, it definitely helps you connect to the music most times, I would say.
Right. And I remember really listening to the words and thinking like, oh, this is actually a story. Like, I've known the words my whole life, but now we can really listen to the story. And so I think that as cannabis influences the music, it's also like if you can get in the mindset of the person that wrote the music and sang the music and smoke a little bit along with them, it just helps me hear it clearer, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's not just a personal thing. I think that's very much universal for many consumers of cannabis. When we consume music, it does allow you to kind of connect on that kind of same spiritual level that the musician wrote in it. And oftentimes, there's many, many, many musicians that use cannabis, you know, for that inspiration.
So I want to also touch a little bit on your brother, Jawara, and his experience with cannabis. He was here in America using cannabis, and as part of the Rastafarian faith here, it doesn't really count for much. So I know that his experience was just an awful one, getting arrested and thrown into jail, where he was beaten and severely injured. And his death almost a year ago, just over a year ago. Also, it serves as a reminder to us how much more we still have to do for justice here in America. For those that still want to use cannabis to influence their music, to use in a spiritual way, and those that are still getting locked up for those kinds of reasons for using cannabis, What more do you think that there is that we can do sort of as activists, I guess, mm-hmm. to ensure that folks here in America who use this spiritually get that access above medical, above recreational? Do you think there's any path forward for that?
Yes, I think it's definitely very, very necessary. As we progress towards, you know, just adult legalization, you know, that's definitely something to look forward to. But you mentioned my brother Jawara, you know, he was arrested in New Jersey before it was legal in 2013, and then really was torn between fighting for what he believed and as the plant being a sacrament for our family and many other individuals, and then also this kind of archaic system of criminal justice that existed within New Jersey, and eventually decided to kind of take a plea. And then, unfortunately, as you stated, led to him being incarcerated and then being brutalized. And I think that as more and more states start to legalize cannabis and write these regulations, there is a part where we are seeing more and more language around social justice and equity. But we have to really recognize some of the sacrifices that really so many people learned about cannabis through music, through reggae music, through the culture of Rastafari. And so many people still continue to use cannabis with that faith as a part of their upbringing. And as activists, it's not only just consuming, but it's really becoming educators. It's sharing the knowledge, passing it forward. And then I think at the state that we are now, you know, I'm very much for regulations without limits. You know, we are trying mm-hmm. to treat this plant like it's cigarettes, like it's alcohol, when it's not. You know what I mean? And cannabis affects everyone differently. And so they're putting quantities and caps on how much people can have on them, or how much THC is allowed in certain plants. And overregulation is definitely not the way to go. We have to really fight for the complete opposite direction. We need just complete freedom for us to be consumers and consume in a way that's best for us. I do really appreciate that New York has at least allowed people to consume cannabis in spaces where people can consume cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in Massachusetts, that's just not the case. You know, although people still consume wherever they want.
They don't care.
But many of the regulations don't really allow for that. And it leaves that one opportunity for, you know, the wrong enforcer to try mm-hmm. to make an example of someone. And so we really have to be a lot more open-minded, because there has been no case whatsoever where cannabis has done the type of harms that cigarettes has done or alcohol has done.
So do you have anything that you're working on at the moment that's focusing on those kinds of issues?
Definitely. We have, you know, the Peter Tosh Foundation, which was founded in 2016. And one of the initiatives is the Legalize It Initiative. And it's really all geared towards education of the history, but also the benefits as well, and partnerships with different organizations like Minorities for Medical Marijuana, where those that have been disenfranchised by cannabis prohibition really have an opportunity to kind of seek an avenue into the industry. You know, we have expungements clinics that we do with them. We also have boot camps for business individuals that are trying to get into the industry. So there's a lot of work that we're doing.
Nice. That sounds awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking a little bit about your experience with the reggae culture and Rastafarianism and cannabis. I'll be sure to catch up with you next time I'm in Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to catch up with you, Britt.
A huge thanks to both David Lopes and Niambe McIntosh for being a part of this episode. You can now buy the book Rockers, The Making of Reggae's Most Iconic Film wherever you buy books. And if that happens to be a Barnes & Noble or a Books A Million bookstore, keep your eye out for the latest issue of Different Leaf the magazine on shelves now. Find your nearest location at differentleaf.com. Make sure you're following us on social media at differentleaf and at different_leaf. And I'm on social media at Brit the British. Music in this episode came from artists including Ketza, Kittis Eye, Peter Tosh, and Bob Marley.
Thanks as always to our wonderful producer, Andrea Maraskin, and thanks to Homebody for our music.